The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network. I want to mention a great resource for writers, and this month's sponsor, Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, a DIY manual for the construction of stories. I'll expound later in the show, but the short version is this long-awaited book about the craft of creative writing from New York Times bestselling author Steve Almond sets out to debunk the well-meaning but misguided myths that hold us back from writing our deepest and most honest work. Pick up a copy today of Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, wherever you buy books, more soon. Greetings, scribes. I have got some exciting news to share. The Writer Files now has an exclusive Patreon community where subscribers will get exclusive access to uncut ad-free interviews, a writer's happy hour, bonus breakdowns, and content from productivity and publishing experts each month. In the meantime, just head over to patreon.com/thewriterfiles. It's free to join Patreon to get a preview, and you can upgrade anytime. That's patreon.com/thewriterfiles. Help us start something special.
Hey, Jared Morris here. If you know anything about Rainmaker Digital and Copyblogger, you may know that we produce incredible live events. Well, some would say that we produce incredible live events as an excuse to throw great parties, but that's another story. We've got another one coming up this October in Denver. It's called Digital Commerce Summit, and it is entirely focused on giving you the smartest ways to create and sell digital products and services. You can find out more at rainmaker.fm/summit. That's rainmaker.fm/summit. We'll be talking about Digital Commerce Summit in more detail as it gets closer. But for now, I'd like to let a few attendees from our past events speak for us.
For me, it's just hearing from the experts. I mean, this is my first industry event, so it's awesome to learn new stuff and also get confirmation that we're not doing it completely wrong where I work.
The best part of the conference for me is being able to mingle with people and realize that you have connections with everyone here. It feels like LinkedIn Live. I also love the parties after each day, being able to talk to the speakers, talk to other people over here. First time, people have been here before.
I think the best part of the conference for me is understanding how I can service my customers a little more easily. Seeing all the different facets and components of various enterprises then helps me pick the best tools.
Hey, we agree. One of the biggest reasons we host a conference every year is so that we can learn how to service our customers, people like you, more easily. And here are just a few more words from folks who have come to our past live events.
It's really fun. I think it's a great mix of beginner information and advanced information, so I'm really learning a lot and having a lot of fun.
Conference is great, especially because it's a single track conference where you don't get distracted by like which session should I go to and am I missing something.
I mean, the training and everything, the speakers have been awesome, but I think the coolest aspect for me has been connecting with both people who are putting it on and then the other attendees.
So that's it for now. There's a lot more to come on Digital Commerce Summit, and I really hope to see you there in October. Again, to get all the details and the very best deal on tickets, head over to rainmaker.fm/summit. That's rainmaker.fm/summit.
These are the Writer Files, a tour of the habits, habitats, and brains of working writers, from online content creators to fictionists, journalists, entrepreneurs, and beyond. I'm your host, Kelvin Reed, writer, podcaster, and mediaphile. And each week, we'll discover how great writers keep the ink flowing, the cursor moving, and avoid writer's block. New York Times bestselling author and co-founder of Wired Magazine, Kevin Kelly, stopped by the show this week to chat with me about his journey from travel journalist to famed futurist. Mr. Kelly's storied and winding career has taken him around the world in search of visions of the new digital frontier. He's a renowned TED speaker and author of multiple bestsellers, including his latest, The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future, a title that offers an optimistic roadmap of how new technologies will shape humanity. Dubbed the most interesting man in the world by Tim Ferriss, Mr. Kelly began writing on the internet near its inception and never looked back, taking gigs including editor for the Whole Earth Review and presently senior maverick at Wired Magazine, a magazine he co-founded in 1993 and where he served as executive editor until 1999. Join us for this two-part interview. And if you're a fan of the show, please click subscribe to automatically see new interviews with your favorite authors and help other writers to find us. If you missed the first half of this show, you can find it at writerfiles.fm and in the show notes. In part two of the file, Kevin and I discuss why the author can't write on the road, the importance of delegation as a writer, the cool tools Kevin Kelly uses to get words onto the page, a futurist's expansive definition of creativity, how lateral thinking can improve your writing, and the day Steven Spielberg asked Mr. Kelly to predict the future.
I mean, do you have an office? Like once you've traveled the world and gotten all the stuff you need and researched all the stuff, do you go back to the office then? Or do you feel like you can write on the road?
I cannot write on the road at all. I can't even write on planes. I can't even write in hotel rooms. I do all my writing here. I have this magnificent studio. I call it studio. It's two stories. It's in California. It's all light. It's a huge ceiling. There's two stories of books. I have all my toys, my Lego wall here. I have a Styrobot. No, it's actually I built it for me and my way of working. Camille's just right over there. I have another assistant too who's does the website stuff. I have all my big, huge whiteboard. I got everything. So I have a standing and a ball, so I can move from standing to sitting mm-hmm. within seconds.
Cool.
I kind of need to be here to really get my writing done. And I have the privilege of being able to control my time that way. Yeah. I don't know if I need to, but that's how I choose to.
Sure.
And that works for me. And you're right about the travel. So when I'm traveling, there's two kinds. There's the traveling for doing talks. So my livelihood is basically giving talks in China. All right. So that's most of my fans are in China. I have, I don't know, 20 times the number of fans in China than I do in the US. And so I go to China to do talks. And because I have this obsession with Asia, I usually will piggyback other trips either in China or elsewhere around Asia when I go, because I'm photographing the disappearing Asia. Yeah. And when I'm in photograph mode, I can do nothing else. It's really weird, but I become totally a camera. Hmm. And just a camera. I'm a walking camera. I started off that in the 1970s doing that. So that's what my first thing was. Instead of going to college, I went to Asia as a photographer, and I was photographing this stuff, and I was a camera. And I worked from the beginning of daylight to the end of daylight as a camera. And still, when I go to Asia, I do the same thing. It's like I am just there. And then when I'm in the hotel, I'm downloading, backing up all my stuff, doing the minimal amount of email that I need to do, and then I'm in bed, and then the next day I'm just a camera. And I find it really hard to – I'm happy if I can do my email. I can't write then. And when I come back, then I can shift in – I'll leave the camera off to the side, and then I can try and write.
Well, it sounds cool. I mean, it sounds like you've got these processes in place that kind of help you to – process crunch all the information you need to, and then you get back to the designated writing space to get into the flow.
The other thing that I learned to do at Wired and working through the magazine was to delegate and hire. So I 10 years, I guess, I did the cool tools myself. Yeah. Five days a week, I was editing. I wasn't writing all those reviews, but I was soliciting, getting them in, editing everybody, sending it back, going rounds of approval, posting it, and finding the pictures, doing the access information. Well, you know, at some point, okay, it made money from the very beginning, and okay, so I'm going to hire editors to do this. And I was overseeing it and kind of like a publisher, but they were doing the work. And that's the other thing that I've learned to do is to hire out. And that's the one thing I wish I'd learned earlier in life, was to hire people better than yourself as a way of extending mm-hmm. your reach. And, you know, Cultools is, Mark is running that basically. Silvercord, my partner in that, is running that. I don't have a partner yet in True Films, but actually Claudia, who is here, is helping me now. And so that's the idea, is the way that I found to leverage my ideas and perspective is to hire whenever I can.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, for scaling and probably peace of mind too, to kind of harness your skills and your creativity. Earlier in the show, I mentioned an invaluable resource for writers. Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, a DIY manual for the construction of stories based on 3 decades of writing, failing, and trying again. Author Steve Almond is a beloved professor at Harvard and Wesleyan and the acclaimed New York Times bestseller of 12 books of fiction and nonfiction. And in Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, Steve employs the radical empathy he displayed as a co-host of the Dear Sugars podcast with Cheryl Strayed, where they explored the joys and trials of storytelling to explode myths that hold us back from writing our deepest and truest work. The book includes chapters on plot, character, and chronology, but travels far beyond the earnest intentions of most craft books. It also includes writing prompts to generate new work. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Russo called it one of the best books on writing he's ever read, and also the funniest. Pick up a copy of Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, a DIY manual for the construction of stories, wherever you buy books, and add it to your TBR today. And just a quick aside to revisit the exclusive Writer Files Patreon community, where subscribers get access to uncut ad-free interviews, a writer's happy hour, bonus breakdowns, and a lot more. I know that for serious writers, it can be more distracting than ever to cut through the noise, stay productive, and home in on what's happening in the publishing industry. Over 8 years, we've provided a looking glass into the habits of professional writers and publishing industry insiders. And as your humble host, I've decided to launch a membership-based Patreon for serious scribes to cut through the noise, swap tips and tricks, and hang out with like-minded peers. Just head over to patreon.com/thewriterfiles for bonus writing resources, monthly episode breakdowns, writer's happy hour, a community of your peers, ad-free episodes, and more. It's free to join, to get a preview, and you can upgrade anytime. That's patreon.com/thewriterfiles. Help us start something cool and special. Keep calm and write on. But speaking of cool tools, let's talk a little bit about the cool tools that you use to actually get words onto the page, if you don't mind. I'd love to know kind of, I know you've got some organizational hacks in place, it sounds like, but are you a Mac guy? Are you a PC guy? Like when you're actually sitting down to get words onto the page, what are you using there?
There's a joke, I should just show you a picture of my, I have a beige, boring minivan, but the back window is covered with little white apples.
Right.
You know, like a million of them, because I have been an Apple user from the Apple IIe.
Wow.
And there was a brief spell in Wired, and right before, we did a famous Wired cover about praying for Apple, because there was a brief spell before Jobs came back that I thought I was going to have to actually make the big switch to Windows. I was within like 2 months of doing that. But he came back in time and saved the day. So I'm a total Mac, or a Mac household. Huh. I have an iPhone. So I work on a Mac they call a Mac Tower. It's a behemoth machine that sits below me. And I have two cinema screens, one at sitting height, one at standing height. And I can just toggle between them. Mm-hmm. That's where I have a little tiny 11-inch Mac Air that I take with me when I travel. Mm-hmm. And it's big enough just to do email and primitive web, and I have my PowerPoint speeches mounted, and that's it.
Yeah.
And I'm not a very mobile person. I mean, when I go out, I only got the first smartphone I had was Apple VI, So I was kind of, I'm old school in that sense of, email is the best way to reach me. I work on a desktop. I'm not mobile. And when I take pictures, I have to process them. So I use a Lightroom, which I think is just fantastic. I don't even need Photoshop. I just use Lightroom for managing my gazillion, which, and by the way, I have them all backed up to, not only Google, but I'm a insane, radical, extreme backer-upper. I have my photos are backed up on three clouds and three different hard disks beyond the cards that I have. And while I'm traveling, I also have them backed up in three different places while I travel. Needless to say, I have never lost an image. So,
Is that known as RAID?
Yeah, exactly. Right. My own version of RAID. Right. Exactly. So the tools I use for writing, eventually I get into Microsoft Word. I don't always start there. I actually, believe it or not, I sometimes start writing in my email. Because it's just like so simple and I'm not going to lose it and I can kind of keep it up. And I used to mail it to myself as a backup as I went along before I had Time Machine.
I like that.
Sometimes the first notes will be in all kinds of things. You know, sometimes they'll be in Google Docs. Sometimes they'll be in my email. Sometimes they'll be in notes. But eventually it gets to Microsoft. But when I'm writing a bigger piece, I actually will move things at some point into Scrivener. And Scrivener is this really cool software that's used by people doing long form writing, whether it be fiction or nonfiction, or even sometimes screenplays. And it's card-based organizing metaphor. So things have cards, and you can kind of move these cards around, and the cards can have an indefinite amount of text in them, and you can kind of put them in hierarchies, or you can kind of keep them flat. But the idea is that you can move all this stuff around. So it takes the place of like the old way, where we actually did cut and paste and had things in piles and move piles around the floor, or cards, index cards on your desktop. And it does that. And it's really, really good for organizing lots of things and lots of parts. And I've used that for the last two books, and I would definitely use it again for any other book I did. So that's on both Mac and Windows. So I'm using Scrivener, but at some point it'll make its way into a Word doc in the kind of final form. And that's just because in my experience working with magazines and the book publishers, this is the universal format. So it just has to reach there at some point.
The track changes and traditional publishing. Well, I kind of skipped over a big one, but here is one for you. I mean, you kind of probably are rubbing elbows with writers, and you have been for much of your career. Do you believe in writer's block?
I don't. If you mean, do I experience writer blocks? That's all I can say. I don't have any, I've never really talked to the other writers about writer's block, so I can't say whether they have it or not. And I have never had them volunteer a conversation about it. Mm-hmm. Like I was just hanging out just last week with all these science fiction authors, very, very, you know, published successes, and that's never come up. I have not experienced it myself. In talking to them about their work habits and stuff, some of them are pretty regular, you know, write every day kind of things, and they'll write about something every day, and maybe it's not about what their book is, but they'll do something. So it has not been an issue in my experience.
Cool. That's good. Knock on wood.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get into creativity a little bit. I know we've got a few more minutes here. I think creativity is probably inherent to a lot of what you do. But it might not be labeled as creativity when you're kind of getting into, you know, technology and kind of looking at the future. But do you think that, you could define creativity for us?
My image of creativity is a diagram in a book called The Act of Creation, I think, by Kostler. It's an old book, and it was his attempt to try and figure out what creativity is. And in his diagram, it's very simple. It's like, imagine I take two index cards that are inserted into each other, so they form from the end a profile of a cross. So there are two planes that are intersecting, right? So you have a flat plane and then a vertical plane. So you have two planes that are intersecting. Mm-hmm. And his idea was that all creativity is basically taking two unrelated planes and making them intersect. And so that's the visual image that I have of creativity, which is you are making a connection, an intersection between things that have not intersected before. And like jokes are kind of like that. Joke is you take two things that don't seem to be related and you bring them together in some way that's plausible and it's funny. And new ideas, new innovations are the same kind of thing where you recombine existing mechanisms, say, in a way that haven't been combined before.
Sure.
Brian Authors and Paul Romer's two separate guys with two separate theories, but they're both the same, which is that the fountain of all innovation is basically recombination. And in fact, the combination of all wealth is actually, the origin of all wealth is actually recombination. You're just recombining things. And so this idea of intersecting things that had not intersected before is my definition of creativity, where there are, of course, rules. I mean, you can't just take any random thing. The new intersection has to work in some way. It has to be, plausible, interesting, whatever. But that fundamentally, that's the act. And so when I see something creative, it's usually because someone has, we talk about the other metaphor of a leap somewhere, but they have stepped off something and they're stepping somewhere else, but they're actually two legs. They actually have a leg in the departure point and a leg in the arrival point, and those two things have sort of not been bridged before. That's my image of an intersection of two unrelated ideas.
Mm-hmm. I like it. I like it a lot. Well, I think that we're getting close here. I have a couple other questions for you, but
let me just say one thing about the creativity.
Oh, I'm sorry.
because I've got to work with many of what I would consider some of the most creative people working today, alive today. People who are technically geniuses, like Danny Hillis, artistically genius, like a Brian Eno. Cultural genius like Stuart Brand. And it's really been interesting to watch them operate. And I think they have trained their minds to do this. And they're doing the thing I'm saying about these unrelated planes intersecting, but they do them kind of in different ways. And like Brian Eno, I'm again and again reminded, is he's kind of like the most lateral thinker I know. And lateral meaning that he's associating ideas that are coming from off to the side. We also have a tendency to kind of maybe proceed in kind of a linear way, or a way in which there are the obvious things in front of you that you may want to combine. But he has an ability to kind of reach off to the side into something that is unexpected and try to make that association that will work. And he's particularly good at reaching kind of behind his back or off to the side, and that's what I meant by laterally, to bring something in. And that ability to, in some senses, dismiss or ignore the obvious ones and to reach for the unobvious that yet still works is something that I think actually they train. And Brian Eno has a famous set of cards called Oblique Strategies, he and a partner used to make music. And these were prompts that they would pick up at random to force themselves to do this kind of lateral thinking. And there were prompts like, take the most obvious thing and ignore it, or pretend that, you know, what about the middle, you know, emphasize the middle, or, you know, there were kind of almost like random things. And often that action would not be the thing that worked, but that would lead them to this other unobvious next step that would work. So that's one way. And those cards are actually very valuable and useful for anything. And I have a deck right here where, and I have my own kind of little internal ones of when you're in the situation, and I say like when you're stuck, you use these things to as prompts, exercises to kind of force yourself to think about these other approaches.
Yeah.
And it's very handy. And I think internally, that's what Brian and others are doing, is that they actually have a set of little things that they're kind of running through, sometimes unconsciously, as they try and prompt themselves to take this lateral approach. Then there's others like Marvin Minsky and Danny Hillis are very technical, and I think they do something very similar, particularly Marvin, which is pretend that they're not human. approach this as seeing as if they were seeing it for the first time, as if they were coming from another planet, as if they were pretending that they were often a robot. And it's like, well, how would a robot do this? To try and do the same thing of look at it with the fresh eyes, look at it in a way that an ordinary human would look at it, and not as the way an ordinary human would look at it. And then Stuart Brand, who also has this ability, I think his little heuristic that he also trained himself to do was to force himself to, each time he approached something, he would force himself to try and find a different perspective on it, including using the words that he used to describe something. He would never, ever, ever repeat himself. So he would, if he was talking about something he knew, he would require that he use different words when talking about this time to this person, even though he'd been talking about it for 1,000 times before. And that constraint would require him, because of the new words, to see it differently. And then he would have an insight just because he forced himself to use different words.
Love that.
And so those are some of the ways that I've seen some of the most creative people I know kind of use this on a daily basis. They have trained themselves to be better at this on an ongoing basis, not just when they're sitting down, but to just as a habit.
For sure.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Yeah, I know screenwriter John August has a similar set of prompts, kind of like the oblique strategies that he uses for screenwriters, which have been proven to be very helpful. And I think writers can use that in whatever way they think to kind of kickstart their writing, for sure. Side note, I love Brian Eno's music for airports, and I actually listen to it while I'm writing, and I find that it helps because it's kind of meandering and ambient, of course. But anyway, I got to slip this one in here. I know that the inevitable and kind of understanding the technological forces that will shape our world, you've talked about VR quite a bit. And I heard you say you were reading Ready Player One, which is Ernie Cline's kind of journey into a VR, what is it, the Oasis?
Correct.
There. So interesting intersection there. I think you've worked with Steven Spielberg in the past, and he is adapting that book into a movie. Have you heard anything about that?
I have not heard either from Ernie or elsewhere about what state the Spielberg Ready Player One is. I've heard different rumors about whether it's actually going to be in VR or not. Mm-hmm. I think there is likely to be some VR component, probably a VR game version.
Yeah.
No, I don't know anything more about it other than what has been published. I think that it's an ideal Spielberg movie for many reasons, and not the least of all the kind of references to the 70s and 80s that I'm sure he'd be very good at.
Right. Well, I thought it was interesting that it takes place in 2044, and he actually tapped you to help him predict 2054 in Minority Report.
Right. Yeah.
So I thought maybe he'd tapped you again.
No. It was just not me. It was a group of us. And as far as I know, none of us, he hasn't reached out in that sense to do that, which was a very, it was a very amazing experience, because there was a set of people, including the people I just mentioned. I don't think Brian was there, but like Doug Copeland and some other, Jerry Lanier, were present, and our job was to make this world in a comprehensive. But what was really interesting, because we did a lot of arm waving about these things, and then Spielberg, you know, sitting in the room, and he's there with his little pencil and pad, and says, "Okay, what are people sleeping on? What do the beds look like?
Mm-hmm.
How about for breakfast? What are people having for breakfast?" So he was really like, it was like, that requirement to be that specific was very, it was galvanizing, because you couldn't just talk about general things. He wanted to know what the beds look like. And so you begin to think, what do they look like? Are they any different, the same? Are they water beds or, you know? Yeah. So that was so profound for me, because that really changed, you know, how I try to think about the future now.
Oh, cool. Well, I really appreciate you taking time out to chat with us about your process, the inevitable, understanding the 12 technological forces that will shape our world, a very optimistic roadmap of the future. Really cool stuff. It's out now, and we can find it out there. You link to it at kk.org, and it's on Amazon. I'll link to your Google Plus page as well, and your Twitter handle. Is there any other sign-offs for writers you want to drop on us before you go to the next interview?
No, other than I do suggest that you look at the Cool Tools book that I did, which was self-published, although it's this huge, oversized, thick, heavy, 5-pound, massive catalog of possibilities. And there are some good writer tools besides Scrivener. There are some other resources for people making things and being creative. Tools, not just like the wrenches and pipes, but things like Elance, or what they would call Upwork these days, how to hire someone for help, where to get a logo or book cover done. So check out that. That's available on Amazon as well.
Mr. Kelly, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Best of luck with all of your press rounds, and hopefully you'll come back and talk to us again another time.
Sure thing. Thanks for the attention. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks so much for joining me for this half of A Tour Through the Writer's Process. If you enjoy the Writer Files podcast, please subscribe to the show and leave us a rating or a review on iTunes to help other writers find us. For more episodes, or to just leave a comment or a question, you can drop by writerfiles.fm. And you can always chat with me on Twitter @KeltonReed. Cheers. Talk to you next week.